How does the gospel make us fearless? A few years ago, I took part in a men's retreat up in New Hampshire. Part of that weekend involved the 30 or so men that were there taking these big sticky sheets of paper and articulating their fears, the things in their life that they were the most afraid of, writing them down with a big Sharpie and sticking them to the wall. And I can still remember that well because when everyone was done, it was a long list. The width and the depth of what was written down was remarkable. So there was fear of losing my job, fear of losing money, fear of losing the affection of a spouse, fear of being alone, fear of failure, fear of rejection, fear of poor parenting, pain, suffering, fear that I'll never be able to conquer my addiction, fear that maybe deep down I don't even want to. Fear is a reality in all of our lives. We know that feeling. We know that we're scared. It's not generally something that we talk about or that we're comfortable admitting, and yet it's something that we all deal with. So there's a question of how do we deal with that? How do we cope with that? Some of us probably lean towards what I would call self-preservation, and that's probably demonstrated in more risk-averse behavior. So sometimes the things that we're most scared about, we try and avoid engaging them because those are the things that make us feel inadequate. So if you're afraid of something, you try and avoid any scenario where you have to deal with it and withdraw. That's one way of dealing with fear. The second would be more turning to something that we'd call maybe more like motivation or self-help. That's where in answer to your fear, you try and find strength from within. You give yourself a pep talk. You'd say, you can do it. You're strong. And try and motivate yourself to deal with fear that way. So we probably would lean one way or the other, sort of self-preservation or self-help. But today we're going to talk about a third way. And that is how does the gospel address that fear? Because what we put at the center of the church, in the center of the church is the gospel. The good news of what God has done for us in Christ. We believe that Jesus Christ brings good news for bad people, for broken people, for messed up people, for people like each one of us. And what Jesus does through his cross and through his resurrection, that forms a new community. It forms a community of authentic relationships, and it forms a place where people have safety, and they have time to see the gospel intersect with the messed up parts of their lives. So how does the gospel address our fear? How does it address our fear? And specifically, how does the gospel address both our individual fears as well as really like maybe fears that we share together, corporate fears as a church? So to answer that question, I want to go to Deuteronomy chapter 1. Verse 19, it's page 145 in the Pew Bible in front of you, and we'll also have this up on the screen. Here's the setup for this passage. Here's the setup. The speaker is Moses. He is an old man at this point. He's leading the Israelites, and they are at the very edge of the promised land. They're at the very border of the land that God has promised them in Deuteronomy 1. And Moses is old at this point, but in Deuteronomy 1, he's actually recounting an episode that happened a long time ago. In the current, the people of Israel are right on the edge. They're at a place called Kadesh Barnea, and from where they stand, they can look out and actually see the promised land on the horizon. And this land is the destination for the people of God in the Old Testament. God has delivered his people out of Egyptian captivity, and the promised land is where he is taking them. They had, we could say it like this, they had a non-negotiable mission. Go in and take this land. That charge predated them by many years. It was promised to their forefathers hundreds of years ago. But as of yet, the Israelites have not completed that mission. They have actually, at this point, been in the wilderness for decades, yet to go in, yet to take it. And right now, Moses is telling the people what happened the last time they got to this point. Essentially, in Deuteronomy 1, Moses is giving them history, telling the current generation how their parents had acted, because they had been here 38 years before. The Israelites had been right on the edge of this land before, and now they're here again. So remember as we read that although Moses uses words like we and you, he's talking about a past tense episode. He's talking about what happened the first time they got to the edge. So verses 19 through 21, you see this on the screen. Deuteronomy 1, 19 through 21. I'll start from here. Then we set out from Horeb and went through all that great and terrifying wilderness that you saw on the way to the hill country of the Amorites, as the Lord our God commanded us. And we came to Kadesh Barnea. And I said to you, you have come to the hill country of the Amorites, which the Lord our God is giving us. See, the Lord your God has set the land before you. Go up and take possession, as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has told you. Do not fear or be dismayed. And where we are today in the setting is that Israel is essentially at the same point where they were earlier with the same question. The land is there to be taken. And the question is, are they going to learn and go in and take it, or will history repeat itself? Will they go into the promised land with faith, or will fear stop them? And let's notice first that Moses does not deny that the obstacles that the people faced. He said the journey to the promised land was great and terrifying. And they're looking out over this land, and they're seeing that it's occupied, and God's saying that he's going to give it to them for their conquest. But they obviously need to do more than just go in. They need to take it. There are foreign enemies that will have to be fought. And yet the command is still there. Go and take it. And of course, they're afraid. Where they're going is completely unknown. They've not been there before. These are unknown enemies. So what's their response? Well, they do something that I think we understand. They say, before we do that, let's collect some data. Let's form a committee. We have some time. There's no need to rush. Let's see what the land is like. So verse 22, then all of you came near me and said, let us send men before us that they may explore the land for us and bring us word again of the way by which we must go up and the cities into which we shall come. It's kind of like saying, let's form an exploratory committee. You're probably hearing that phrase around this time. So our next presidential election is still almost 2 years away, but a lot of potential political candidates for 2020 are forming exploratory committees. That means they're trying to gather, essentially, whether or not their potential campaign would be viable. They're doing research, they're raising money, they're trying to figure out, would a run at the presidency be embarrassing, or is it viable? And forming an exploratory committee, whether it's political or whether it's in this sense, it's not a bad thing. That's what the Israelites want to do. They say, let's send men out to check out this land. And God does not condemn that. And Moses says, verse 23, the thing seemed good to me, and I took 12 men from you, one man from each tribe. Seemed good to them, verse 23. Seemed good to him, seemed good to them. Let's go, let's check it out. 12 men are chosen for this mission. They're representing the 12 tribes of Israel, one from each tribe. And think about this. What an opportunity. What an opportunity for these men to lead with courage and to lead with unity and help people get ready to go into the land that God's prepared for them. These men are given their instructions. It's actually recounted in more detail in the book of Numbers. But basically, they're told, go in, see what the land looks like. See whether those people, see whether they're strong or weak. See whether this land, whether it's good or bad. Figure out, are these people living in camps? What are they doing? Are they rich? Are they poor? What's the fruit like? What's the land like? You go do some reconnaissance, figure out what's going on in there. God allows this search party to form, and 12 men go up into the hills on a research mission. Verse 24 and 25. And they turned and went up into the hill country and came to the valley of Eshcol and spied it out. And they took in their hands some of the fruit of the land and brought it down to us and brought us word again and said, it is a good land that the Lord our God is giving us. What God had said about the land was true. So the spies come back and they're carrying huge chunks of fruit. And they say, yes, it's exactly what God said it would be. It's a very good land. And the physical evidence is there to prove it. There's really no denying it. You can feel it. You can taste it. It's right there. God said it was a good land. You can see it. It's a good land. The fruit was in their hands. God had said that it was a bountiful land flowing with milk and honey. And sure enough, the spies come back and the evidence is right there in front of them. And two of the spies, Joshua and Caleb, they say, let's go up now and occupy it. We're well able to overcome it. And the rest of the spies, the other 10, say, well, it is just like we've heard. However, and then they start talking about everything that made them afraid. The fortified walls, the multiple tribes that they're unfamiliar with that occupy the land, and especially these people called the Anakim, who are reputed to be giants. They start talking about all that, all the things that they are afraid of. Verse 26 through 28, and the response of the people proves that the search party was not really about research in the end. It was a stall tactic. Verse 26 through 28, yet you would not go up, but rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. And you murmured in your tents and said, because the Lord hated us, he has brought us out of the land of Egypt to give us into the hands of the Amorites to destroy us. Where are we going up? Our brothers have made our hearts melt, saying the people are greater and taller than we. The cities are great and fortified up to heaven. And besides, we have seen the sons of the Anakim there. They would not go. They rebel against Moses. And more importantly, they rebel against the direction that God had given them. So there was nothing wrong with sending a party to go investigate the land, but it was not on the table to not take the promised land. In other words, there's nothing wrong with research, but to not investigate, to not actually go in, was not an option. In other words, the research expedition was fine. Being careful, being prudent, that was fine. But it was not an option to redefine God's purposes for them. And that's what's happening here. When the research party meant to the people is really that they would get to decide whether they would obey or not. That they would get to decide whether they would obey the Lord's command. It was good to be prudent and cautious. But the Lord here brings them to a confrontation. The Lord brings them to a point where they see they're pretenders. They were identifying as God's people. They were doing the thing. They were pretending to follow after God. But when the battle came, when the confrontation came, they were not prepared to obey. They were not prepared to obey. One of the books that Pastor Rob read on his sabbatical, he's gotten me into, and I've been reading some stuff by Frances and Edith Schaefer. And one of the things that she wrote that is really convicting, I want to put this up on the screen. There's an Edith Schaefer quote where she says, "The inward battle to be honest before God when one asks, 'Show me thy will,' is a very real struggle. It is so easy to clutch to oneself certain things which really erase the whole request and annul it. Many Christians want the excitement of a reply from God, but not the pain of the struggle." And here's the irony. What the Israelites want is safety. What they want is safety and protection. But what they believe is that there's safety outside of obedience to God. They want safety, but they believe that they need to take care of themselves, that safety is outside of the obedience of God. They see that the situation is dangerous, right? They see that they have enemies, and they decide that where God has led them is unsafe. And what's the belief here? It's the idea that behind data is peace of mind. If only we knew enough, we could fix everything. Or it's, If we failed, it's because we didn't have enough information or didn't use the right method. So research and prudence is good, but there's something more going on here. There's a variable. There's an emotional variable outside of data, and it's simply this. Do you believe that God is trustworthy and good? That was the question for the Israelites. Do you believe that God is trustworthy and good? Because look what's happening here. God's not denying the size of their enemies or the enormity of the task, this huge open land that will need to be conquered. He's just calling them to go in and do it despite of that. And the reason is that God himself is giving them this land. And under the guise of prudence, Israel says, no, they're pretty big. They're pretty big. And it looked wise to them. It seemed wise to them. And I think this is where we need to ask, how many of us are doing that with our fears? Do we think, maybe we wouldn't verbalize it like this, but do we think that there is a safer place than absolute obedience to God? Because that's exactly what the Israelites believed. When the people hear that the land is occupied and some of the occupants are pretty big, they say, we're not doing this. Verse 27 tells us they murmured in their tents. In other words, they're talking to each other. And they say, because the Lord hated us, he has brought us out of the land of Egypt to give us into the hands of the Amorites to destroy us. And somehow in some twisted way, the Exodus, God's great deliverance of his people out of Egyptian slavery, has come to represent to them God's hatred of Israel. And do you see how twisted that is? You might say, like, how could they possibly have come to that conclusion? How could they have gotten so hysterical after all that God has done for them to deliver them from slavery? It's kind of like that paranoia. Like, it's kind of like that when you're a 6-year-old or an 8-year-old, you start to wonder whether your parents are really your parents, or your grandparents are really your grandparents, or whether your whole life is an elaborate hoax and you're the only one that doesn't know, right? Or it's a little bit like Jim Carrey in The Truman Show. Like, you're the only person left out of the secret, and there's some evil puppet master pulling the strings on your life. And we say, that's ridiculous. That's something that little kids do. I have a good friend named AJ who planted a church in Philadelphia. God gave him a vision to start a church among second generation Indians like himself. He was part of a generation of whose parents had moved over from southern India, but who was himself raised in the United States. And he had a desire to see these people, these friends of his, reached with the gospel. So he moved to uproot his whole life and his family, moved to Philadelphia to start a church there. Church planning for bold people like that sounds amazing on paper, but there is a point where you get terrified whether anyone will ever come, whether it will be anyone anywhere to meet, whether there will be any money, whether God will do anything with your efforts. There's a point in church planning where you start to just desperately sit and talk with anyone who will listen to see if they might possibly be interested in your church. And I remember him sharing at one point early in this process that he started to believe that God had brought him here just so that he could fail. Do any of us identify with that? We say, oh, these Israelites, they're so hysterical. Like, they believe that God delivered them from Egypt because he hated them. God had brought my friend favor, money, a great core team of workers, a building. But we're subject to that fear, that paranoia. Oh, God just brought me all the way out here so I could crash and burn. And the Israelites, they rebelled. They murmured against God. Their fear controlled them. They were actually believing lies about God's character. Remember, they had seen, not that long ago, they had seen God part the Red Sea. Water had actually moved vertically so that they could pass through and be delivered from their enemies. God had given them 10 miraculous plagues. They actually plundered the Egyptians when they left. And yet they're tempted to believe it was all an elaborate setup. 2 million people in the desert, just so that God could demonstrate how much he didn't like them. But this is actually a human temptation. We are tempted to believe God is not for us. We do this too. This is one of the most basic temptations, to doubt the goodness of God. You could say it like this. We tend to look at God's faithfulness, and we tend to examine his goodness through a microscope lens instead of through a wide-angle panoramic view. We look really, really close, and we see only our present circumstances and what makes us afraid. And God calls us to a wide, broad look at his faithfulness. Moses says in verses 29 through 31, "Then I said to them, 'Don't be in dread or afraid of them. The Lord your God who goes before you will himself fight for you, just as he did for you in Egypt before your eyes, in the wilderness where you have seen, and in the wilderness where you have seen how the Lord your God carried you as a man carries his son, all the way that you went until you came to this place.'" Moses is saying, you are afraid of this promised land. You're afraid of giants, but do not be afraid. God is tender and loving. He's not hateful. He's carried you all this way. He's carried you all this way. But obviously we see that unbelief in God's character goes hand in hand with actual rebellion. Verse 32 to 33. Yet in spite of this word, you did not believe the Lord your God, who went before you in the way to seek you out a place to pitch your tents, in fire by night and in the cloud by day, to show you by what way you should go. And this twisted unbelief in God causes them not to obey and inherit the land that they are called to go into. See, at the end of the day, our actions are a reflection of what we truly believe to be true about God. The text tells us about what God is like and what God has done. Moses says, God himself will fight for you. He says, God is both tender and powerful. God has all power, and yet he's so tender, he carried you like a man carries his child. He calls them to trust. So here's where we ask, is there a situation like ours at all? Is there any correlation? Do we have a battle with fear? Well, specifically, individually, we have individual callings that take great courage. Each of us, if we thought probably 15 seconds about it, each of us could think of something that God is calling to us to where we taste fear on a daily basis or on a regular basis. It may be that God is calling you through suffering. It may be that you're in a season of discouragement. It may be that you know there's a hard conversation that you need to have. It may be that you need to humble yourself and ask for forgiveness. It may be that you have sin that needs to be confessed and brought out into the open. All those things. We're fearful of those things. It may be that there is a step of faith that God is asking of you. You're afraid. Individually, we need the Lord to address our fears. Generally, or more corporately, this is for all of us, we have a calling from God to be a faithful, fruitful, Jesus-exalting church. To show Buffalonians, to introduce Buffalonians to Jesus, and to teach them to follow him in every area of life. So every faithful church has a God-given mandate to go and to make disciples. There's no negotiating that. There's no redefining that. We must be faithful to that call. We can trust God with what those numbers look like, but we must be faithful. And we also must know that opposition to that work is inevitable and to be expected. So a faithful church is involved every day, every week, in the battle against the world, the flesh, and the devil. A disciple-making church, one who is pointing others to Jesus, those churches are actively pursuing people and calling them out of the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of light. That will involve uncomfortability. And we're called to act with faith and not with fear. But what should be, whether we're talking individually or corporately, what should be the basis of our confidence? It's not inner motivation. It's not self-protection. It's this. If we belong to Christ, if we belong to Christ, then we belong to a God who is tender and powerful. And he will fight for us. So we ask, when we delay, when we gather information, when we put something off, are we doing that out of wisdom and prudence, or is it just to delay? Is it because we actually think obedience is something that could be negotiated? When God says, don't be in dread or be afraid, this is rooted in his faithfulness. So let me ask you, where are you forgetting the faithfulness of God? Where do you need to remember God's faithfulness and let it spur you on to confident action? And where is God calling you to act in faith and not in fear? We belong to a God who sent his son to enter into the abyss of fear. We could say it like this, that Jesus took on our fear in a very cosmic sense. He faced that fear. The greatest fear is ultimate separation from God. Jesus took that on for us. We believe in a God who is strong and loving and gives us the courage to face fear. That's the individual application. I want to talk a little bit about the application for us as a church. So we just said we exist, this church exists, so that we can introduce other people to Jesus, that they would learn to follow him. Our vision in the upcoming years is that we would see 150 Buffalonians and their children believing the gospel and living on mission. I think those people are going to come from three different groups, primarily. I think we're going to see people coming from Amherst, just families from Amherst. I think we're going to see students coming from the University of Buffalo. And I think we're going to see our neighbors in these surrounding apartments. Those are three. Obviously, there's commonalities in those people, but those are three distinct people groups. But they're the ones who must know that this church exists, whether they're looking for a great church or whether the Lord brings suffering or difficulty into their life and they begin questioning their lives. They need to know of a church offering the hope of Jesus. And we need to begin connecting to these people groups in specific ways. So I want to give you some things that we can expect on a very practical level in 2019. Things that we can pray for, things that we can have faith in. You can look forward to us in 2019 beginning to connect with UB in much more intentional ways. We already have some things in the works towards that. We're going to begin developing increasingly fun and safe and well-led gospel-centered ministries for our kids, but also for our teenagers. We're actively looking for and praying for a dedicated children's ministry worker. So I'll say that again because this will be big. We are actively looking for and praying for and are intending to hire a dedicated children's ministry director. And we're praying that our new garden is going to prove to be a great connection point with our neighbors. It's going to provide a context for us to love and to listen and to speak about Christ with our neighbors. You can also expect that Pastor Rob and Eric will play a vital role. You know that in my role as a lead pastor, I'm going to be providing primary leadership in terms of preaching and communication. But I'm not alone in that at all. Rob has returned. He's providing leadership for our worship services, to our Sunday morning volunteer teams. He's working on creating a men's ministry. Together, we're working to develop continued prayer ministry in the church. Those are just some things that are on the horizon right now. But I want to say it like this. So there will be change coming in the church. I think you all know that. But I'm very, very grateful to have Rob and have Rob and Terry together with us. This is not an interim period where we're expecting him to disappear, right? Eric, we know, has a full plate. Eric has a full plate. We know, with family, full-time job outside of church. But he's going to continue to serve, teaching, and shepherding. Really, really grateful for Eric and for the Fireleys. I know that some of you probably have financial questions. How's that all going to happen? We're a small church. How's this going to happen? We have two pastors. You're talking about a children's ministry director. Our building has constant needs. How are we going to... The simple answer is this. God has provided for us. We believe that he's going to continue to provide. I think you all know, I'm grateful for, we have a financial team that's continuing to provide us with prudent counsel and with faith in God's provision. You probably want to. We've got 2019 budget in the back there, so I would encourage you to take a look at that on your way out. You can take that with you. Here's what we need. Let me say it like this. Here's what we need from you. This is in the biggest sense. Bought in people that want to be part of this church. We need to be a praying church. We need to be praying for God's provision. We need to be praying for leaders. We need to be praying that God would open up doors for us to speak the word in this community, at the college, in our backyard. We need to be praying for that. We need to be together in prayer. We need to be a unified church. So I said, things will change, and that's going to be a good thing. But we need to be unified and together and bear with one another and love one another in that. Not mumbling or grumbling or questioning, but talking transparently and honestly and with love with each other. We need to be a generous church, and that means open-handed in our energy, in our relationships, with our money. And we need to be excited about serving with our gifts wherever God has called us. I'll say this, in February, I don't think we've done awesome in figuring out how everyone in the church plugs in and also is discipled. So we'll be, in February, we'll be on an elder retreat and we'll be able to provide more structure for that and figuring out how can each one of us be serving and be growing in our walk with Christ in this church. But here is what will absolutely not change. The gospel at the center, the power of God for salvation. The gospel forms a community and makes us family. And the gospel gives us a mission. And we really believe that Jesus loves the people in our towns, in our cities, and that we're surrounded by people who have never heard about Jesus, or if they have, it is only a caricature. So that's just kind of exactly what Jen just pointed out to us. We are here to introduce the real, living Jesus in our neighborhoods, in our workplaces, in our towns. And we need to together build a church that can do that as faithfully and as fruitfully as possible. So would you pray with me? Lord, we look to you in faith. You know the places where we are prone to fear. And Lord, I pray that you would minister to us there, that we would see that you are tender and powerful and loving, that you have faced fear on our behalf. And I pray, Father, that you would, by your Spirit, equip us with all that we need. Individually and as a church, equip us for all that we need so that you would be glorified in our midst. I pray that in Jesus' name. Amen.